This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The current drought is deeper than we've experienced for the last 150 years in some ways, and it's imposed on a system where we've put in place all of these really big demands for water as well. So we aren't going to have enough water to do all of the things that we would like to do.
...2013 was the driest year on record in California, and the state's snowpack is at 12% of what it should be. Considering that this state alone houses an eighth of the U.S. population, maintains over 25 million acres of farmland, with a GDP larger than that of Canada, the current California drought reaches well beyond the borders of the Golden State. Today on Sea Change Radio, I talk with Peter Glick, president and co-founder of the Pacific Institute. We discuss the realities and implications of the current water crisis, how better agriculture policy may help lessen its impact, and look at some of the innovations that have been developed in other arid geographies. I'm joined now by Dr. Peter Glick. He is the president of the Pacific Institute. Peter, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
So you are an expert on water and climate issues and a Californian.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you first tell us what California is going through right now in terms of its water, in terms of this drought, and what that means for everyone around the country. Why it's important beyond just California's borders.
Indeed, we're going through a drought, a particularly bad drought. It looks like we're entering really the third year of a below normal precipitation and runoff. And of course, we have higher temperatures as well from climate change. And we have droughts normally. We have floods normally. It's a naturally variable climate in California, as it is really everywhere. But this is an extreme drought, and it's going to have impacts on urban water use. We're not going to have as much water in our cities to do the things that we would like to do. It's going to have an impact on our agricultural production, and California is a big food growing state, and 80% of the water that we use in a normal year goes to agriculture, and there are going to be limits on what we can grow and where we can grow it this year. And it's going to have impacts on our ecosystems. You know, our ecosystems are already enormously stressed by the human use of water that takes water that those ecosystems used to rely on, our fisheries, our salmon runs, our wetlands. And there's always pressure, competition, if you will, between the cities and farms and ecosystems. And that's going to be particularly severe this year as well. And what it means for the rest of the country is, in part, some probably higher food prices for some of the things that we produce and export. But it also, I think, means a growing awareness, not just here, but elsewhere, that we really ought to be doing different things about our water management and our water policy. I think all of those issues are going to come into play this year.
And from your perspective, do you view this drought as a cyclical thing, or is this somehow related to man-induced trauma of the environment?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it's a difficult question. We have droughts and floods normally. We have a variable climate. Obviously, California's had droughts periodically, and we have wet years and dry years, like everywhere. We also know, however, that humans are now changing the climate. We know that climate change is real. The scientific community's in very, very strong consensus about that. And, one way to phrase it is that we're now as sure that humans are changing the climate as we are that smoking tobacco causes cancer. It's that degree of certainty. And we also know that as the climate changes, our weather will change. The weather is just the short-term manifestations of climate. Climate is the long-term average of our weather. And we know temperatures are going up. We know sea levels going up. We know precipitation patterns are changing in different parts of the world. So the argument is not, is this drought caused by climate? Nobody argues that. But more and more, what we have to realize is that all of our weather to some degree is now influenced by our changing of the climate. Temperatures are higher than they would otherwise have been. That means a bigger demand for water. We know that higher temperatures means that the precipitation we get in the mountains is more likely to be rain now than snow, and it's going to run off earlier, and that means a change in the timing of water availability. This climate may be influenced, this particular drought may be influenced by climate, and it's certainly what we've got to start planning for in the future as the climate changes get more and more severe.
It's fairly depressing to think that we may run out of water, but at least that's the view that man has had some kind of impact on it and that there are some ways that we can change it. But I read a link that you had shared on Twitter, and people should definitely follow you. It's at Peter Glick. That's G-L-E-I-C-K. It was a Mercury News article by Paul Rogers talking about some of the long droughts that California has had in the past back in 1,500 years ago, mm-hmm. and droughts that lasted a couple centuries. And we've actually had a pretty good run here in the last 150 years, although right now this drought is the worst in California's recorded history. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we measure droughts differently in different ways. Droughts are really a combination of what nature gives us and what humans want. So this is a drought because it's dry. We're getting less rainfall than normal, but it's also a drought because our demand for water is much larger than what we're going to get. So really, it's a combination of the natural situation, but also the infrastructure we've built, the economy we've built. There is evidence in the what we call the paleoclimatic record. That's the record of ancient climates that we figure out from looking at tree rings. We look at sediment cores and pollen records that tells us what kind of vegetation we had 1,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago. There is evidence of longer, deeper droughts a long, long time ago. But of course, we weren't around then. So what we really care about is the record that we've had for the last 150 years and the infrastructure we've built to deal with it. And in that sense, the current drought is really, really bad. The current drought is deeper than we've experienced for the last 150 years in some ways. And it's imposed on a system where we've put in place all of these really big demands for water as well. So we aren't going to have enough water to do all of the things that we would like to do.
And Jerry Brown, governor of California, just recently declared a state of emergency based on the drought conditions. What does that mean? It hasn't had the same impact, I think, on a population as it had in the 80s or in the early 90s. Are there steps that people can take that really will make a difference? And what do you attribute this drop in consciousness to?
Well, partly because of the system we've built, because of our reservoirs, because of our sort of mixed set of water sources. You know, some of us get water from rivers and some from groundwater and some from rain and some locally and some through big infrastructure projects that we've built. We've been somewhat insulated about drought. So we can have a drought for a year or two and people can sort of ignore it. People can get by without any serious cutbacks. And what we're seeing now is the third year of a drought. It's getting worse and worse. I do think there is now growing public awareness about this. And I think if the drought continues, you know, we had probably the driest January on record this month. If the drought continues, then there will be more public awareness. There will be more and more programs put in place to ask for conservation and efficiency improvements to change the way we do things. Farmers are making decisions right now about what to plant and how to grow what they're planting, how to irrigate what they're planting. Some of those decisions are going to be dependent on what they think their water availability is going to be. So part of it is awareness is growing. We'll see how bad it really gets. But the other part of it is that the governor's declaration, in some senses, was unnecessary. We didn't need a governor's declaration to tell us that we're in a drought. We know we're in a drought, and there are things that we ought to be doing with or without state insistence or requirements or pleading. But the government's declaration also does free up some options. It gives them the ability to provide some emergency financial relief in certain circumstances to facilitate transfers from one water user to another. There are some good things in the governor's declaration. There are also some, I would argue, some worrisome things that I wish the governor hadn't done. But we'll see what the reaction's going to be depending on how dry it continues to be.
in terms of consumers of water, the citizenry, let's leave agriculture out of the conversation for now. Where are some of the areas that people can still make a difference? I know that bricks in the toilet was a thing of the 70s, 80s, and even early 90s, but toilets have changed their volume. Where are some of the ways that people can do the most to save and conserve water in their home?
Well, let's split this into two pieces. There's enormous potential for conservation and efficiency, even despite the improvements we've made over the last couple of decades. And on the urban side, the residential, commercial, industrial side, there are two ways to think about it. One is the short-term temporary responses that we're asked to do, changes in behavior, for example, during severe droughts, the voluntary cutbacks that tell us don't wash your car as often or at all, or don't water except every other day, or get rid of your, you know, don't water at all and let your lawn go brown. Take a shorter shower. Those are behavioral changes, and they're short term, and they have the potential to save 10 or 15 or even 20%, depending on how enthusiastically people adopt them. The second, though, is more permanent changes in infrastructure. And you mentioned toilets, and toilets is a good example. The largest user of water in our homes is typically our toilet. And in the old days, 20 or 30 years ago, the average toilet used 6 gallons every time we flushed it. And the new, modern, more efficient, effective toilets use 1.6 gallons or even less every time we flush it. So that's a permanent change in efficiency. It lets us do what we want, which is get rid of our wastes with much less water. That's an efficiency improvement, and it doesn't require a change in behavior, and it's a permanent improvement. And there are lots of potential in that area as well. You know, lots of us have got modern efficient toilets, but there's still lots of old inefficient toilets and washing machines and shower heads out there that could be replaced and ought to be replaced. And the drought is perhaps an opportunity to once again pay attention to some of those more permanent improvements in efficiency that have let us do the things we want with less water.
Sunshine, blue skies, please go away. A girl has found another and gone away. With her went my future. My life is filled with gloom. So day after day, I stay locked up in my room. I know to you, it might sound strange, but I wish it would rain.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the president of the Pacific Institute, Peter Glick. So, Peter, let's turn to agriculture. You mentioned that our agricultural industry consumes 80%, approximately 80% of the state's water use. But in the same breath, it only accounts for around 3% of the economy, according to some calculations. How do we rectify that disparity?
Yes, by some estimates, our agricultural sector uses 80% of the water that humans use in California. The other 20% goes to industry and commercial and residential use. And it is a very small fraction of our total economy. It's under 10%, depending on how you measure it, maybe under 5% of our economic productivity. But California is a wonderful place to grow food, and our farmers do a wonderful job at producing an enormous amount of the food, the fruits, the nuts, the agricultural production that the rest of the country and, in fact, much of the rest of the world consumes. So no one's arguing that we shouldn't grow food in California. I think the question moving forward in the 21st century really is, how can we have a strong and healthy agricultural economy, grow food in the Central Valley and the other parts of California where it makes a lot of sense to grow food, but do it with as efficiently as we can to free up water for other economic values to free up water for ecosystem protection, which are also important things to us. It's a balance, really. And again, sort of like the urban sector, the agricultural sector's made a lot of improvements in the last several decades. We're growing more food with less water. We see a shift away from flood irrigation to sprinklers or from sprinklers to precision drip. We see a change in cropping patterns over time, but a lot more could be done.
Such as?
Well, so for example, even today, even with the improvements we've seen in the agricultural sector, probably 40% or more of the ag land in California is still flood irrigated.
And what does that mean? Is that similar to what I've seen in Japan when they grow rice?
Yeah, so rice is obviously a crop that requires flood irrigation, where you flood the fields. But many other crops are still flood irrigated as well that don't require flood irrigation, that could be on sprinklers or drip irrigation. There's probably 10 or 15% of our orchards are still flood irrigated, which is unnecessary. And inefficient. You lose a lot of water to evaporation, unproductive evaporation in those basins, and that could change. And we still grow a lot of crops that are very water intensive, cotton, rice, alfalfa, irrigated pasture, that use a lot of water, produce less revenue to farmers than vegetable crops or fruits and nuts. And so over time, I think we are already seeing, and we should continue to see, shifts in agriculture that hopefully let us have a strong agricultural economy, but perhaps free up some of the water for other uses.
I'm almost afraid to open up this Pandora's box, but let's talk about some of the political infighting over water in California. If you've driven on Highway 5 from Los Angeles to San Francisco, you've inevitably encountered a lot of signs from angry farmers decrying that Congress created this dust bowl, and plenty of sore words for Nancy Pelosi in particular, I've noticed. Where does the complaint stem from?
That complaint stems from the belief that federal protections for ecosystems are depriving some farmers of water that they think they ought to be able to use. It's the sort of classic conflict between human uses of water, in this case, agricultural uses of water, and natural ecosystems. We've put in place at the federal level a few protections for our natural ecosystems. The Endangered Species Act, which says, you know, thou shalt not let species go extinct if you can help it, has been applied, you know, nationwide to species that are threatened. But in California, many of those are fish species. And there have been in the last decade or so a few efforts to restore a little bit of water to natural ecosystems that farmers either think they ought to get to use or used to use. And so that's really the heart of the complaint. It's misguided in the following sense. Most of our water is local. The federal government has nothing to do with it. But it's also misguided in the sense that the amount of water that's been restored to ecosystems is pretty small. It's actually relatively tiny, and it wouldn't really make a difference in bridging the gap between the amount of water that we would like to use if water were unlimited and the amount of water that we're able to use because water really is limited. I would also argue that that stems a little bit from general anti-government feeling in the Central Valley anyway. It's been played up by some of the local congressmen and some of the local political representatives as a way to gain political support among their constituents.
We've spotlighted here on Sea Change Radio in the past the battle between oil extraction and pumping water into the ground to try to get every last drop of fossil fuel out of the ground, their demands, increasing demands for water and farmers. Does that play into that as well, that complaint from the farmer, or is that maybe an issue that they're missing?
So this is sort of a new issue. It's an interesting one, and we're actually doing some research on this now, looking at the water requirements for oil and gas operations and potentially the water requirements for expanded oil and gas fracking or other kinds of methods to expand production in the what we call the Monterey Shale, which is California's version of the Marcellus Shale back in Pennsylvania and the Bakken in North Dakota. There is interest in exploring whether or not we can produce more oil and gas, and that requires water. I actually think that the amount of water required for those operations at the moment is pretty small. And that's not really the big point that we should be focusing on. I'm much more concerned about the potential for oil and gas operations to threaten groundwater resources. When you expand production of oil and gas, you drill a lot more wells. If there are well casing failures, there's a risk that you can contaminate with the chemicals used in the oil and gas production process. You can contaminate groundwater with those chemicals. And failure rates on wells are very low, but they're not zero. And I think much more attention needs to be paid to understanding the kinds of failures that are likely to result, where we're likely to expand production, the kinds of chemicals that are involved, and what the risks to groundwater are likely to be. I think that's an unknown risk, and it's a potentially serious one that's worth a lot more attention than we've given it in the past.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the president of the Pacific Institute, Peter Glick. Let's go back to the doomsday scenario of just an extended drought here in California. It's not a question of running out of water. It's a question of making water affordable for the way we're using it. People don't have to worry about turning on their tap and getting air anytime soon. Tell us some of the alternatives in a doomsday scenario where we would have expensive water, such as desalination, for example.
Well, it's true that the issue really is not running out of water. We're not going to run out of water in this state. We have droughts, we have floods, we have wet years and we have dry years. There's variability. The better way to think about it is that we are constrained in the things we can do. We don't have enough water to do everything that everyone would like as inefficiently as we're currently doing those things. There are constraints. We can't grow food everywhere we want, and we can't grow water-intensive crops everywhere we want, and we can't run our faucets without running into limits on how much water is available. So in a worst case scenario, if this drought continues and deepens, if we are really in a different climatic regime now, then those constraints are going to get worse. And we're going to have to make more and more difficult decisions about what we do and how we do it and what we pay and how we're willing to allocate the water that's available among the different demands. I think if it continues and worsens, I think we're going to see much more aggressive urban conservation efforts to cut our per person water use even more than we've already cut it. And there's the potential to do that. If the drought worsens, I think we're going to see some real conversations, maybe for the first time, about what we grow and where we grow it. We might want to give more incentives to farmers to replace irrigation systems or to change crop types to help them make a transition to a drier climate. We're going to have discussions about providing water rights to the natural environment, to protect the natural environment to some degree. Interestingly, these are the kinds of conversations that they ultimately had in Australia during what they call the Millennium Drought, which turned out to be a 9-year drought, very, very bad. Severe drought started in the year 2000 and kept going year after year. And they finally had to have a bunch of conversations about water policy that up until that time they hadn't been willing to have.
Speaking of Australia, can you look towards other countries or other urban areas outside of California that have had some exemplary conservation efforts that California could model?
Sure. Now, you know, we've certainly made progress in California. Our per capita urban water use is below what it used to be. We're improving efficiency all the time. Our fixtures are more efficient. But again, there's a long way to go to be really efficient in California. And per capita water use in Australia, for example, the amount of water they use per person in residential water use for dishes and toilets and showers and lawns and outdoor landscaping is much lower per person than it is here in California, even where we've made progress. So there are examples we can look to. There are better technologies that we can apply. There are better incentives that we can give to homeowners to change the way they use water. And we're going to see more and more of those during this year's drought. Incentives to replace lawns, for example. Lawns are incredibly water intensive, and yet more water efficient, beautiful gardens are certainly possible. I've gotten rid of all the lawn in my garden. I don't have lawn in my garden anymore, and my outdoor water use has dropped enormously. But even I know that I could do a better job in my home cutting water use. And I think as water becomes scarcer and we learn more about the constraints and incentives are provided by water agencies, I think we'll do more of the right thing.
So what are some of the specific measures that they took in Australia to reduce per capita water consumption?
Well, so they worked very aggressively to reduce outdoor water use, which is really the big one, especially in the Central Valley of California. A lot of the majority of our residential water use is outdoors. Among the tools that they've used were, first of all, they had absolute limits on the amount of water you could use outdoors. They had constraints on, you know, when you could water and so on. And that encouraged a lot of people just to get rid of their traditional old English-style humid climate gardens.
So if you were caught watering your garden out at the wrong time, you could get fined or something?
You could in some communities. There was also partly just the sort of the public perception that we don't have enough water for lawns anymore in Australia. And so if you had a lawn, I think people began to look at you funny. And so people provided incentives. Water agencies provided incentives for replacing lawns with drought-tolerant plants. Los Angeles offers a cash payment to remove your lawn. Las Vegas pioneered that. They offered for a while $2 a square foot to get rid of your lawn and replace it with drought-tolerant plants or low-water-using plants.
And I know Las Vegas, also their golf courses are using a lot more reclaimed water, right?
That's another opportunity. That's right. That's a chance to replace a very expensive, high-quality, potable water with water that you can use to water a golf course, with pretty high-quality reclaimed water. So we ought to be using much more reclaimed water. And that's the more we can recycle, collect wastewater, treat it to a high standard, and then reuse it. That's, in a sense, a new source of supply. And I think it's going to be incredibly important in California. We're, again, slowly moving in that direction. But that is another good option.
Are people using gray water in Australia as well?
Yeah, there's gray water systems where people are collecting their the water they use in their own homes that's not contaminated with soaps or oils or dirts and using that on gardens. And there are new gray water regulations in California as well, encouraging people to use gray water. I've just moved a bucket into my shower to capture the water in my shower that's extra that I can use on my gardens and my plants.
He's the president of the Pacific Institute, Dr. Peter Glick. Peter, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Galactic, The Temptations, and Talking Heads. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.